This is Michael Bohm, and you're listening to the Youth Apologetics Training Podcast. Welcome, friends. What you're about to hear is a collection of older, shorter podcasts that have been condensed into one larger podcast. Back when I first started this ministry, I recorded all these old podcasts on a BlackBerry phone. Okay, nowadays we're, as you can tell, have much better audio and music, a professional microphone. But back then I was using a BlackBerry phone and I recorded very short podcasts. And then these 5 to 15 minute podcasts, I would put them up online. But now I'm going back through with the help of one of my listeners, Seth. Thank you, Seth. He is going back through and taking these older podcasts, these long series, and condensing them into longer 45 minute to an hour podcasts. So some things to look out for, obviously. Bad audio, at least during the beginning, when I was using this BlackBerry phone. You're also going to notice a difference in audio quality from time to time as I jump from one 5 to 15 minute podcast to the next one. And that brings up another thing. Sometimes there are slightly awkward topic or subject matter jumps. And that is simply because the end of one podcast has hit and then the next one was spliced on. I apologize about that, but it is what it is. So with that, let's go ahead and jump into today's podcast. Hey, this is Michael Bohm with Youth Apologetics Training. How you doing today, guys? We're going to start a new series today. It's going to be on evolution and creation. It's going to be an introduction to this topic. This topic is so broad and wide. There's so much to cover. In fact, evolution and creation will probably be a theme that I will come back and visit over and over and over throughout the years, adding to my podcast archive of evolution and creation topics, because there's just so much to cover. But let's just get down to business. What exactly does evolution teach? So I would like to, in layman's terms, give you guys the teaching of evolution. And some of your parents out there are probably going, what? And that's right, I just raised my voice an octave, what? And that's because we need to know what evolution teaches before we can really refute it. So, what do we got? According to evolutionists, the Big Bang happened about 20 billion years ago. And exactly how that is they say that an infinitesimal dot that apparently was just floating around in the middle of nothingness started getting hot. I'm sorry, guys. This is comical to me. And it started spinning around, and it exploded. And this little dot, this infinitesimal dot, exploded, and all of the matter that we see, and I'm talking like all these planets, all these stars, and everything floating around in space, all came from this tiny little dot that got hot and exploded. But no, really, seriously, guys, we got to take this serious because it definitely did happen. Okay, now all these chunks of rock were flying through space, and somehow the dust came together and formed stars and planets. Totally believable there. And then we come to our own planet, so we're just looking at us for now, and it was a molten rock. So this is just a big old chunk of rock. And it's really hot, and it's like molten lava, and the clouds formed, and it started raining on the rocks. And it rained on the rocks for millions of years. By the way, I should mention that they're saying Earth is about 4.6 billion years old. Now,
That date will continue to change because science evolutionists, I have nothing against science. I have a problem with the interpretation of science nowadays. But this 4.6 billion year old date, that'll just keep changing as they change their mind and come up with more goofy ideas. And the 20 billion year old Big Bang, that will probably change if it hasn't already changed by the time you listen to this podcast. So the rain on the rocks, it formed an ooze. And this ooze was rich with amino acids and proteins and all the chemicals needed for life. And somehow the ooze came alive. And once again, it's very believable because it happens in my refrigerator every day. That ooze comes alive. I open up the fridge and my wife yells at me. Anyway, sorry guys, I'm in rare form today. Anyway, so around this time that the ooze came alive, they're saying was around the 3 billion year mark. And basically from there, this first one-celled organism, started replicating itself. It had its own genetics, and somehow it found a way to get energy. Who knows what it was eating, or if it was somehow using light from the sun or whatever, but somehow it found a means to get energy, and it started reproducing itself because, you know, that's what things do when they randomly come to life out of ooze. And once again, just ask my refrigerator. Anyway, and this ooze replicated itself, and the more times it replicated itself, every once in a while, its genetics would have a mistake. It would make a mistake in its genes. And the genes, for all you out there that don't quite get this, everybody has their own genes, their own genetics, and this is the code that is written in your body to make you, exactly how you are. And as these mistakes happened, you would have now basically, in the smallest form, a different organism. And this different organism, with its new mistake, was either worse off or better off. And the ones that were better off continued to live. And the ones that were worse off, well, they didn't live as long. And so as time went on, millions and millions and billions of years of all these mistakes and the bad ones, the bad mistakes, those organisms generally died. And the good mistakes, well, that just made them bigger and better and faster. And eventually, here we are, the humans. And eventually we're gonna evolve into X-Men, and we're all going to have Wolverine claws and be flying around like Superman with blue tights. But that is, oh, I'm sorry, guys, that's basically the theory of evolution in layman's terms by Michael Boehm. Now, we will be looking at all the definitions of evolution. If you guys listen to my logic teaching, the logical fallacy of equivocation, you'll know that here in the next teaching, we're going to talk about how equivocation is used in the term evolution, because there's actually 6 different definitions of evolution. Only one of them is true. And by the way, just in case you guys might have missed all the sarcasm, I don't believe evolution happened. I am not into theistic evolution parents. I do not believe that anything evolves unless it's on a micro scale, like if you have 2 flies that go ahead and make a bunch of little maggot babies, they can do that forever and ever for millions and millions of years, and they will always have flies. They will always be flies. They'll never be anything other than that. Just ask the scientist that beamed hundreds of generations, I think thousands of generations, of flies with radiation and different ways to cause mutations. They still got flies. So we're going to get into evolution a little deeper, and I'm going to introduce all of these interesting side roads concerning evolution that as the coming months and years progress, we will choose to go down at different times as I build up my archive on apologetics concerning evolution and creation. I'm going to read a evolutionary formula to you, and I'm going to see if this makes sense to you. Nothing plus nothing equals two elements, plus time equals 92 natural elements, plus time equals all physical laws and a completely structured universe of galaxies, stars, planets, and moons orbiting in a perfect balance and order. Okay, some of you are kind of looking at me with a blank stare right now. Hang with me. How about this one? Forget that one. What about this? This is the evolutionary formula for making life. Dirt plus water plus time equals living creatures. Isn't that wonderful? If you guys didn't follow me on that, that's okay. The whole point is we're talking about evolution. And we just started this series yesterday. We're going to be discussing in this series the six different definitions of evolution and how only one of them actually happens. The other five don't happen. The one that does happen, folks, don't get worried. I'm not going to get theistic evolution on you. It's something that we all accept. And even the most staunch fundamental Christians accept this form of evolution, and it's okay. It's when the science classroom sneaks in these other five definitions, and you see it on TV too. That's where I have a problem, and we're going to discuss them. Everybody get out your pens and paper, and I want you to write down these six if you don't already have them. I took them from a ministry called Creation Today. This particular ministry is young earth creationism. That's right. They believe the earth is young. And if you guys haven't noticed, I haven't tipped my hand yet. I haven't told you if I'm young earth or old earth. I actually did that on purpose because, I want you guys to think about this for a while. I want to make a few points here and just ponder this for a few days. I don't know when I'm going to tip my hand, but you better believe I will. I actually have very strong feelings about my position, but I want you guys to think about this. Jesus said, they will know you by your love for one another. Folks, we should be loving each other. And I know that when I do tip my hand and show you which position I feel is correct and I feel quite strongly about that, I'm going to make a lot of you mad. And I apologize right now. I love you guys. And I want you guys to realize that there are some nuggets of truth found in both camps. Side has a lot of good material to help you refute evolution. In this age of the earth question, it is very controversial, and it makes people quite mad. It's kind of like pre-tribulation rapture and post- and mid-trib rapture theories. If you guys don't know what that is, that's okay. We may or may not cover that someday. It's not really something, it's not really an apologetics issue. Anyway, I'm getting sidetracked here. A lot of people get angry about this topic, and I just want to tell you guys, even if you disagree with me, and I will defend my position quite well. But let's say you disagree with me. Fine. Listen to what I have to say. You will find a great deal of good apologetics nuggets, one, that you can use to defend your faith. And two, at the very least, you'll understand what those bad guys believe on the other side that are beep, earth creationists. Ha ha. Okay. So that's right. I'm not telling you. Let's go into the six definitions of evolution. Again, I took them from Eric Hovind's ministry, Creation Today. First one, cosmic evolution. That is the origin of time, space, and matter, basically the Big Bang. The second definition of evolution is chemical evolution, the idea that the origin of higher elements came from hydrogen alone. They have to have hydrogen as the sole element in this Big Bang. Kind of strange. It's somehow from hydrogen, we get all the other elements. Definition number three, stellar for planetary evolution, actually, and stellar and planetary evolution. And that would be the origin of stars and planets. Number four, we have organic evolution, the origin of life from inanimate matter. And five, macroevolution, changing from one kind of animal into another, kind of like when a fly evolves into a pterodactyl. It happens all the time. In fact, it happened to me last Tuesday, and I was like, what the heck? I'm a pterodactyl. I don't know what's going on. Anyway, sorry, guys. And number six, microevolution. And this is the version of evolution that all of us believe. Variations within kinds. My wife and I, we had a child. She had different color hair. She looked like a mixture of the two of us. And yet there were parts of her that were a little bit different. She was still ours, and she did not evolve into a werewolf. Okay? Only this one part, or this one definition of evolution, has been observed. Okay, that was easy. So in the coming, basically next six podcasts, we're going to be discussing each one of these versions of evolution. And I'm going to give you a few good scientific reasons as to why that, except for one of them, that definition is incorrect and really should not be included in the definition of evolution. And what Eric Hovind points out is that once people realize that there are actually six different definitions of evolution, they find it much more difficult to defend their position. And in a sense, you get the upper hand almost immediately. Again, guys, I'm not tipping my hand here, but I am saying there is a great nugget of truth right here in the young earther creationist perspective. So check it out, all you old earthers. Maybe I'm with you, maybe I'm not. And if I'm not, then I'm going to call you a bunch of heretics. Just kidding. So we're going to talk about cosmic evolution. And I, when studying up for this teaching, my goodness, there's a lot of material out there. I wanted to give you, in layman's terms, this is not scientific terms, there's no doubt about that. So all you scientists out there, back off, man. I'm trying to get this as simple as possible, okay? So I was trying to find somebody's rendition of the Big Bang Theory in simpleton's terms. And on bigbangtheory.com, I found the following. And I think it's pretty good, and it's honest. Here we go. Quoting bigbangtheory.com. According to the standard theory, our universe sprang into existence as singularity around 13.7 billion years ago. There's that date again. It just keeps on moving. Anyway, keep on going here. What is a singularity and where does it come from? Well, to be honest, we don't know for sure. Sorry. Okay. Get serious here. Singularities are zones which defy our current understanding of physics. They are thought to exist at the core of black holes. Black holes are areas of intense gravitational pressure. The pressure is thought to be so intense that finite matter is actually squished into infinite. Oh boy, I really want to try and get infinite into your brain because this is impossible. Infinite density, a mathematical concept which truly boggles the mind. These zones of infinite density are called singularities. Our universe is thought to have begun as an infinitesimally small, okay, think of infinity, infinitesimally small, infinitely hot, really, infinitely dense something. Let me try to read that again because I think I got out of control here. Our universe was thought to have begun as an infinitesimally small, infinitely hot, infinitely dense something, a singularity. Where did it come from? We don't know. Why did it appear? We don't know. Okay, that's the end of the article. Well, that's the end of the quote. Okay, let's try to get our brains around infinity. We're talking about a number that keeps going. It never stops. It's basically an impossible number. And what they're saying is this singularity, this little dot, is A, infinitesimally small. As in, oh boy, it's the number just keeps going. That's how small it is. In other words, guys, literally what they're saying is nothing. They're saying that an area, if it's infinitesimally small, means it is not there actually. It's nothing because it's infinitely small. It's not even there. Okay, let's say infinitely hot. Really? Infinite. Guys, a number that never stops. It never stops. Okay, if you had an infinite number and you divided infinity in half, what would you have? You would have two infinities. What if you just had all the even numbers of infinity and you subtracted them from infinity? You'd only have the infinity of odd numbers. What would you have? You would have infinity. Are you starting to get this? Infinity is an impossible number. And they're saying, in it, infinitely hot. Where did the heat come from? Where did this density, infinitely dense, as in it's dense into infinity. So why could the Big Bang not have happened? Okay, and we're going to do this really fast because I've already gone over the 5-minute mark, and I can see now that I could do an entire series, and a long one at that, on this subject alone, and I kind of suspected that. But anyway, let's do an introduction to this subject and try to nail it out really fast. Why do we know the Big Bang explosion couldn't have happened? Okay, really quick, what that article did not mention is this singularity existed in a complete vacuum, as in it existed in an area, and you can't even call it an area, of total nothingness. Okay? And so here we have a singularity, this infinitesimally small, dense, and hot dot. Okay? And somehow it packs itself together, but you can't push anything together in a vacuum. And in a vacuum, there is no density. A vacuum has no density. Where did the ignition for this explosion come from? You're talking about something that is infinitely small, that apparently is eternal, and it exploded. And I'll get into that eternal problem later. But where was the ignition, and how do you expand it? How can you expand what isn't there? Even if your vacuum could somehow be pulled together by gravity, what would then cause this big pile of emptiness to push outward? And nothingness cannot produce heat. How do you have something infinitely small be also infinitely hot? Impossible, guys. Also, in this explosion, you would have produced the same amount of antimatter as matter. What in the world is antimatter? It does actually exist, or doesn't exist. Anyway, yes, scientists have been able to produce antimatter. The problem with antimatter is antimatter, you know, it's antimatter. It destroys all matter. If the Big Bang did happen, it would have produced equal amounts of matter and antimatter, and it would have collided and destroyed itself. How in the world did this happen? Okay, and then we're led to believe that all of these particles shooting outwards through this frictionless space, we're talking about a total vacuum, there is nothing to slow these particles down. Okay, when you explode something, things don't collide with each other in the air. They all move outward in their own vector, in their own direction. Okay, so one, there is no way to unite the particles. The particles are rushing out from a central explosion, and they would have just kept going and going. Secondly, outer space is frictionless, and there would be no way to slow the particles down so they can try and form some kind of a gas cloud and make a planet. Third, the particles would have maintained the same vector and speed and direction forever. Guys, we have planets. We don't just have exploding dust flying outward forever. We have planets and stars. Fourthly, there's no way to slow the particles. They are traveling at supersonic speeds. Fifthly, there's no way to change the direction of even one particle. And six, how could their atomic structures even originate anyway? We'll get into that in a couple days. A lot of my material today I pulled out of a book called The Evolution Handbook. Boy, of all the books out there on evolution, this thing is like thick as a brick, and it's got everything in it. I mean, it covers the whole gamut, and it's ridiculously cheap. We're going to talk about stellar and planetary evolution. And that is the idea that stars and planets somehow evolved, formed out of this Big Bang. So, the Big Bang, we talked about a infinitesimally small, infinitesimally hot, or infinitely hot and infinitely dense little dot, which was basically nothingness. If it's infinitesimally small, then it's small in such a way that it goes on into infinity, which is absolutely absurd and ridiculous and can't happen, but that is basically just nothing. And this nothing got hot and started spinning around and exploded, and basically all of this dust flew outward from this explosion. Now, scientists say that this explosion was just helium and hydrogen, which are two of the elements, the lightest elements on the periodic table, and we're going to talk more about those guys tomorrow and how somehow we got all the elements on the table from just those two guys there. So this Big Bang caused all of this helium and hydrogen to fly outward in an explosion-type pattern, kind of like when you blow up a balloon, you've got the skin of the balloon, it's all going out uniformly outward. And now we're supposed to believe that somehow different clouds of helium and hydrogen started forming around each other and pulled together to form planets. Now, first of all, helium and hydrogen are gases, and according to several studies, basically laws of science, Boyle's gas law to name one, hydrogen and helium are good at spreading out, but not very good at clumping together. So we have a problem right off the bat, but we're supposed to believe that somehow this gas formed our stars. Now, another point is that analysis has revealed that there is not enough matter in these gas clouds to produce stars. We also know that gas clouds in outer space expand. They don't contract. And I want you guys to think about this. In an explosion, everything is moving out uniformly. It's all moving out from the center. And we're supposed to believe that somehow this gas did several things, this explosion, all these particles going outward. They, in a frictionless space, they slowed down, they changed directions from going outward, so they had to change directions, and then they had to somehow start swirling around each other as this theory of cause or stellar and planetary evolution postulates. They had to start swirling around each other. Okay, so we've got all these changes of directions happening in a frictionless space, which in frictionless space, an explosion would have just sent stuff outward forever. It wouldn't have stopped, it wouldn't have changed direction, and it certainly wouldn't have started swirling around each other. Now, when the stuff started swirling around, well, when you guys get on a merry-go-round and you start going fast, if you let go of the merry-go-round when you're going fast, will you collapse inward to the center of the merry-go-round, kind of like this supposed formation of stars, or will you go flying off and hit your head on something? You'll fly off. Why is that? But it's centrifugal force. You start spinning around, you're going to go outward. Well, for whatever reason, these scientists forgot about that, and they're thinking that somehow all of this stuff happened, you know, these particles flying outward stop or slow down, change direction, and then swirling around each other. Start swirling around each other, and then they collapse in on themselves and form stars. There was a man named Hurwitz who did a study on the mathematical likelihood that hydrogen atoms could stick together. Now, this Hurwitz character was not a creationist, not at all, but I'm going to go ahead and quote out of this evolution handbook here, and again, guys, you ought to get this book. It is sweet. It's got all kinds of goodies in there. It just covers every single angle of evolution. And no, it doesn't have every possible answer out there, but I'll tell you what, it's thick as a brick, and if you throw it at somebody, it'll hurt. So, anyway, Hurwitz's research dealt with the mathematical likelihood that hydrogen atoms could stick together and form tiny grains of several atoms by the random sticking of interstellar atoms and molecules to a single nucleus as they passed by at a variable speed. Using the most favorable conditions and the maximum possible sticking ability for grains, Hurwitz determined that the amount of time needed for gas or other particles to clump together into a size of just 100,000th of a centimeter in radius would take about 3 billion years. That is billion. Using more likely rates, 20 billion years would be required to produce one tiny grain of matter stuck together out in space. So let me get this straight. We're supposed to believe that somehow an infinitesimally small, infinitely hot, infinitely dense particle got hot, started spinning by itself, and exploded. And this explosion caused all of this hydrogen and helium to go flying out in an explosion-like pattern, just in a circle, in a sphere, and somehow these particles started slowing down, changing direction, and swirling around each other, and then somehow overcame the gas laws and collapsed upon themselves, forming stars. And this happened randomly, by chance, and it happened trillions of times across our gigantic universe. And, well, against all science, that's what we're supposed to believe. Folks, I have a feeling the Bible is probably right. And I think that some of these evolutionary scientists might need to rethink what they're talking about here. Here's another quote from the Evolution Handbook. It's also concerning expanding gas. Novotny's research findings are also very important. Novotny, in a book published by Oxford University, discusses the problem of gaseous dispersion. It is a physical law that gas in a vacuum expands instead of contracts. Therefore, it cannot form itself into stars, planets, etc. Chemical evolution, what is it? Well, according to the Big Bang Theory, in the beginning, when this singularity exploded, the only two elements that were produced, according to scientists, is hydrogen and helium. Now, this is going to be a little complicated, and I apologize. I'm going to try and simplify it as much as possible without completely destroying this concept. We have a whole periodic table full of elements, helium and hydrogen being the lightest of the elements, and somehow evolutionists believe that all the other elements evolved, that's right, evolved from these two elements through process of stars exploding, okay? So let me read a quote from the Evolution Handbook here and see if we can't get this a little more in view. It says, quote, "The first stars which were formed were so-called first-generation stars, also called population 3 stars. They contained only lighter elements, hydrogen and helium. Then all these stars repeatedly exploded. Billions upon billions of stars kept exploding for billions of years. Gradually, these explosions are said to have produced all the heavier elements." Okay, so let's get to problem number one. There are some gaps between these atomic weights of different elements, and these gaps exist at both 5 and 8. And so what they're saying is hydrogen and helium, even if they were involved in stars exploding, would have basically an impossible time trying to get past these atomic weight gaps. And science has acknowledged these gaps. They call them the first one they call the helium mass 4 gap. And this is basically caused because a proton nor a neutron can attach to a helium nucleus of mass 4. That is so confusing to some people. If you're following me, awesome. If you're not, that's okay. We're going to get to more easily understood concepts as we go here. But basically the whole idea is that stars exploding, these population 3 stars, these would be the ones that are only composed of helium and hydrogen, would explode, and that would cause, through a really hot reaction, these heavier elements. But this has never been observed, and many think it's actually impossible. But nonetheless, this is what we do know. Let's assume that maybe it's possible. What we find right now when we search the sky is no population 3 stars. Now, back when this theory was dreamt up, was back in the 1940s, and our telescopes were only capable of looking 5 billion light years out into space. So scientists came up with this idea that, well, 5 billion years ago, the population 3 star explosions that were causing the heavy elements suddenly stopped, which I think is kind of convenient. But today we have telescopes that can see 15 billion light years out into space. And yet we still don't see any population 3 stars. And again, the population 3 stars are the stars that are made of the hydrogen and helium, the ones that are supposedly making all the heavier elements. So if we can see 15 billion light years out into space, basically only 5 billion years after this supposedly, Big Bang 20 billion years ago, and we're still not seeing any population 3 stars, I think their theory is lacking a little bit. They're having a hard time finding any evidence to support this idea. In fact, these distant stars that are 15 billion light years away, they're able to look at these stars with the Hubble telescope, and they see that these stars actually contain heavier elements. This isn't working out too well for them, guys. Why is it that 15 billion light years out into space, we're finding stars with heavier elements when we are told that the Big Bang started with only 2 light elements, helium and hydrogen? This doesn't make sense, and it doesn't add up. When you add up the fact that helium and hydrogen would have had to cross these weight gaps of 5 and 8, those are the 2 gaps that they have a hard time crossing, and the fact that distant stars, we cannot find any population 3 stars 15 billion light years out. And what we do find 15 billion light years out is stars containing heavier elements. I think the evidence lines up quite well. Chemical evolution did not happen. So what is organic evolution? It's the idea that life came from non-life. So the most popular model right now as to how this happened is, basically, at some point in Earth's history, the molten Earth cooled and oceans formed. As rain fell, chemicals in a hypothetical pool warmed by the volcanic activity and energized by lightning organized into proteins, lipids, and carbohydrates. These molecules then organized into cellular structures like proteins, DNA, and cell membranes. Some of you guys are glazed over and going, and I understand this is very complicated. And the whole idea is that all of the complex components that are needed for life somehow formed by pure random chance in some muddy water when lightning struck it. Now, there's lots of problems with this. But let's talk about these structures that all formed, and they needed to form all around the same time in order for this organism to come to life. Now, why would I say that? Well, if you had a DNA strand, if it's not within a living organism, it would break down fairly quickly. So you've got a problem with a very complex strand of DNA. Eventually, someday we'll get into that, but DNA is ridiculously complex. And somehow it came together by complete random chance, which is utterly improbable and impossible. But let's just say that happened. What other problems do we have? We have to have amino acids form also randomly and by pure chance. You can form amino acids using basically what they're saying here with lightning and a pool of scummy water. But when they did this in an experiment, Miller and Urey had this strange contraption. You can look it up on the internet. But when they did that, they produced left and right-handed amino acids. Now, this is so complicated, guys, and I'm sorry. I'll try to keep it as simple as possible. Amino acids come in left and right-handed forms, kind of like you have your left and right hand. They're exact mirror images of each other. Well, that's basically what you can get with amino acids. Here's the problem. Only left-handed amino acids can be used in proteins that can be used for life. So what do I mean by that? Amino acids make up proteins, and you have to have left-handed amino acids to make these proteins used for life. Why is this a problem? Well, in nature, or rather in this experiment where they had this lightning strike, you had a mixture of both left and right. Now, if one right-handed amino acid gets stuck in this long chain of complicated amino acids that are supposed to form this protein, you just screwed up the whole protein. So you have to have a whole slurry of left-handed amino acids to form each one protein. And each protein, you need somewhere around 80 proteins just to make the simplest form of life. So you've got these amazing hurdles that you have to get over. Each step is absolutely impossible, and one day we will get into this. It'll take a whole series to get into all the complexities in order for this one cell to come to life. Once this one cell comes to life, he's got more problems. He's got to reproduce himself. He's got to have somehow encoded in his DNA a means of reproducing himself. He needs to be able to replenish his energy, however that may work, whether he's got to eat or whatever, and he's got to survive, to name a few things. All right. Sounds easy enough. What else do we know? We know that DNA, going back to the whole DNA problem and how complex it is, it takes protein to form DNA. But DNA is the only thing that can make protein. Huh. So here's a good summary that I got right out of the evolution handbook. It basically goes as follows. One, there are 20 amino acids. Two, there are 300 amino acids in a specialized sequence in each medium protein. Remember, guys, you need amino acids to make a protein. So three, there are billions upon billions of possible combinations. Four, the right combination from among the 20 amino acids would have to be brought together in the right sequence in order to make one usable protein properly. Five, in addition to this, the ultra-complicated DNA strands would have to be formed along with complex enzymes. That's right, we didn't even talk about them, and there's still more. And that all has to be done at the same moment. Now, evolutionists will say, but there was billions of years for this to happen. And you also have to take into account that it's billions of years of this action happening all over the planet, all the time. But even with billions of years and the entire planet, we're talking about lightning striking muddy water and producing all of these situations, the amino acids, all left-handed, folding into proteins, and at least 80 of those proteins at that, all being present at the same time as a complicated strand of DNA, being there present as well, also impossible, and they all had to form at exactly the same time and exactly the same spot in order for life to come about. And then that life had to be able to sustain itself, stay alive, and reproduce itself. All right, let's get into macroevolution. So exactly how does evolution happen? According to science, how does this happen? How do we start with this one-celled organism, whatever it was, and suddenly, millions of years later, we've got the entire human race and all these animals? Well, it starts with mutations, supposedly. Every time that a cell replicates itself, every time that an organism reproduces itself, rather, and its genes, its genetic code is copied, there is a chance of a mutation. Mutations are real. They do happen. The theory goes that every once in a while, a mutation is beneficial. In other words, it helps the organism, the new baby organism has a new advantage, a survival advantage over its parents and its ancestors. And so this new organism is naturally selected. You hear that phrase, natural selection. Well, nature selects the bigger, the better, the badder, the tougher organism. The organism with that mutation edge, it gets selected as the survivor, and it reproduces itself more vigorously, I guess, than its ancestors, and its ancestors slowly die off because they don't have whatever survival advantage this new organism has. Okay, cool, makes sense. There's one problem. There has not been one single beneficial mutation ever observed by science. If you take a course in biology, they'll bring up things like sickle cell anemia, which makes immune to malaria. There's one problem to that. 25% of your children will die. That's kind of like saying being born without feet is a beneficial mutation because you won't get athlete's foot. So that's not really beneficial. Other examples of beneficial mutations are bacteria that become, or they allege, they become immune to antibiotics. This is not a mutation. Rather, it is certain strains of bacteria are already immune to that antibiotic. And when the antibiotic is not used all the way, not all of the bacteria is killed, but most of it is. And the ones that are surviving are the ones that are already immune, and so they reproduce themselves. And the rest is history. They have a strain now that is isolated and is immune, not a beneficial mutation. Let's move on. Have we ever seen the arrival of a new species through evolution? No, we haven't. And science has been attempting for a long time to produce some kind of an example in the lab of evolution. Here are two quick examples. One is E. coli. Here's a quote directly out of the Evolution Handbook. It says, quote, under favorable conditions, bacterial cells can divide every 20 minutes. Then their offspring immediately begin reproducing. Theoretically, one cell can produce 10 to the 20th power cells in one day. If you guys don't know what that is, that's basically the number 10 followed by 20 zeros. That is a huge number, okay? Let's go on. For over a century, researchers have studied E. coli bacteria. All that time, those bacteria have reproduced as much as people could in millions of years, yet never has one bacterium been found to change into anything else. There's still bacteria and there's still E. coli. How about this study? There was a study done on flies, also from the Evolution Handbook. Let's look at that. Multiple studies have been done on fruit flies, and they're trying to mutate them to some kind of other species. Flies, when they're born, from the time they're born to them reproducing is 12 days. So you can go through a generation of flies in 12 days, which is absolutely amazing. There are scientists that have devoted their entire lives to reproducing thousands of generations of fruit flies. They have brought in mutational factors to increase the rate of mutations that happen in the genetics of the fruit flies by 15,000%. That's quite a bit of percent. And after all these decades of research, all we still have is flies. We haven't come up with anything else. They're still flies. What about plant research? Many studies have been done on plants, trying to get plants to mutate. Here's a quote direct out of the Evolution Handbook. It says this quote, "As with animal life, so with plants, it was found that most mutations resulted in harmful effects and sterile life forms. Many of the plant mutations involve splitting and reattaching chromosomes. Most were found to be lethal." We're starting to see a theme here, guys. What about all the farmers who have been reproducing corn for hundreds of years, trying to come up with that perfect ear of corn? You ever notice that none of those corns evolve into a banana? We still have corn. We've got thousands of different varieties of corn, but none of them have ever evolved to something else. Okay, so let's think critically about this. What we're supposed to believe is that through these small mutational changes, new organisms arise. Okay? Well, one small mutational change is actually not enough. What you need to have is the arrival of brand new organs to have a new species. You need to have something different about the animal. An example would be when the bird supposedly evolved. A bird needs hollow bones. They need avian lungs. They have a different heart. These are all changes that can't happen little by little. It has to be all at once. The bird either flies or it dies. You can't have a heart that is halfway evolved between a four valve and a three valve. These systems are said to be irreducibly complex. An irreducibly complex system is a system that has to have all of its subcomponents together, all in one spot at the same time, in order for this system to work properly. More on that in a different podcast. Let's keep going. There was a study done in the 1960s, the Benzar studies, and this Seymour Benzar discovered a chemical way to immensely increase mutations. He found a way to increase the mutation rate by 10,000-fold. And what did he conclude from the study? I quote from the Evolution Handbook once again. Boy, you guys got to get this book. It's got some interesting stuff. Anyway, mutations were not 99% harmful to DNA and the organism, they were 100% harmful. It was discovered that in every instance, mutations caused some kind of damage, always. The researchers learned that DNA coding in the gene simply will not tolerate much change. More than just the slightest amount will ruin the code, and the organism will be greatly weakened. Let's sum this up. We're supposed to believe that mutations happen randomly by chance in organisms, and this gives them an advantage in the world of natural selection, a survival advantage. But we have never recorded a beneficial mutation. We have tried to cause mutations in fruit flies, E. coli, plants, and many other studies, and have yet to produce a new species. We have problems with irreducible complexity, the fact that you have to have all components of an organ there at the same time before it can be beneficial. And until that point, it's not very beneficial. And we've got the fact that this Benzar study found that 100% of the mutations that we, or they, recorded were harmful. Guys, macroevolution, I don't think it happens. Microevolution is these small changes that take place within a particular species. I'd rather say kind. That's the biblical way to address different animals. There's different kinds, like there's the dog kind, the horse kind, the cat kind. You guys get my point. Within the genetic code of each kind of animal, there is a certain amount of variation that happens. And let's look at dogs, for example. We have short hair, long hair. We got big snouts, little snouts. We got wrinkly dogs. We got dogs with weird tails, long tails, fuzzy tails, bushy tails. But they're all still dogs, unless, of course, it's a Chihuahua. That's not a dog. I don't know what it is, but that's not a dog. It is some kind of foul creature from the pit of never mind. Anyway, I'm sorry. Okay, so we've got all these different dogs, but when you allow them or when you selectively breed them for a specific trait, you'll get fairly identical dogs. As soon as you allow them to start interbreeding again, they will start looking like a mutt again. Every kind of animal has a certain amount of variation within its genetic code that allows it to adapt to its environment a little bit better. And without going into too much depth, that's basically microevolution, and everybody believes that. People that breed dogs, people that breed horses, they see this all the time. But when they breed their horses and they try to select for a certain trait, they don't end up with an elephant. It's still a horse, and it never ceases to be a horse. So, now that we know these six definitions of evolution, how can we use this when we're talking to people? How can we use this to share our faith? So let's look at one way. There is lots of ways, but I'm going to show you one way. And I think I've used it myself and have had some really cool conversations with people about evolution. Now, by the way, when I'm talking to you guys on this podcast, I get a little cocky and I have a little bit of fun with it. When you're talking to somebody else and they're not saved, friends, be gentle, be loving, do not be prideful, do not be cocky, okay? These are people just like you before you were saved. They don't know, okay? And if you get cocky or prideful, they're going to shut you down and they're not going to hear what you say, okay? Enough said, let's move into it. So, we talked about these six definitions. So if somebody asks you, do you believe in evolution? Or, you know, something along those lines, a conversation comes up about evolution. Ask them if they knew or know that there are actually six different definitions of evolution. And then you want to go through and explain to them what they are. Again, be gentle. And if they don't want to hear it, well, then they don't want to hear it. Chances are they'll be a little bit interested. Every time I've asked, they have been interested. So you explain the six definitions. And try to remember not only the six definitions, but a little bit as to why each definition doesn't quite work. You may have to use that. In fact, most likely you will, depending on what version of evolution they're talking about. But once you open their eyes to the fact that there's six different definitions, they immediately start feeling a little insecure about the whole thing because they realize, holy smoke, so much has to happen. Okay? So then you find out from them, what do you mean by evolution? You know, in light of the six definitions, what do you mean by that? By the way, anybody out there who is curious, I'm using somewhat of a hybrid approach to a book I read by Greg Kokel called Tactics. I am telling you guys, that book is sweet. That book changed my life. That is one of the best books I've ever read. It teaches you how to navigate an argument or a debate or just a conversational situation. Even if you don't know what you're talking about, you're able to navigate the conversation and be winsome and come out looking like you're a clear thinker. And it helps you to witness to people. It gives you a game plan for witnessing to people as well. I love that book. I don't agree with everything Greg Kokel says, but I'm telling you, you guys should all own it. It is one of the best books I've read. Anyway, enough said on that. So you find out what definition of evolution they're talking about. Then you ask them, why do you believe that? And you find out. You find out what their reasons are. Now, guess what? You guys don't know everything. Neither do I. If you don't know how to answer the reasons why they believe that in a winsome and intelligent way, it's okay. Say, huh, that's interesting. I'll look into that. Big deal. You don't know something. They'll be impressed with you looking something up, learning about it, and coming back and talking to them. Don't get nervous. Don't get red in the face. don't feel like you got to make them fall on their knees and repent before a holy God and give their life to Jesus right on the spot. You don't have to do that. In fact, a lot of times that happens in private anyway. Okay? So find out, why do you believe that? And if you have a good answer for them, sweet. If you don't, that's okay. Keep talking and learn more why they believe it and look it up. If you guys have questions, write to me on youthapologeticstraining.com. Get a hold of me, and I'll try to steer you in the right direction. Even if I don't know the answer, I know people that do. Moving on. Now that you've kind of got a feeling of where they're going and how they believe and why they believe, sometimes a fun question or direction to take them when you realize the conversation is somewhat over, explain to them that basically evolution is the only naturalistic explanation, the only naturalistic game in town, basically. If evolution didn't happen, then we have a creator. Does that make sense to you guys? Am I pulling a false dichotomy here? If the world did not evolve naturally, then we have a creator. Somebody created this mess, right? So ask that, you know, basically explain that to them, and then ask them this question and say, you know, if I ask you a brutally honest question, would you give me a brutally honest answer? And I'm thinking, of course they're going to say yes. Then you ask them, if you found out that evolution was wrong, would you believe in a creator? And see where they go with it. If they flat out tell you no, and especially if they tell you with a little bit of force, chances are their mind's pretty closed on this subject. You might even be wasting your time. And I hate to say that. Even when I'm wasting my time, I don't give up on witnessing to people because I can't help it. But after the fact, I always kick myself and say, man, that, you know, I already knew that their mind was made up and they were never going to change. But, you know, I guess let the Holy Spirit guide you on that. But what you do with that question is you allow them to really consider themselves. And if they are really honest with themselves, then they should answer in the affirmative that if they did in fact find out evolution was wrong, then they must logically conclude that there is a creator. Now, this doesn't get them to the cross by any stretch, but it sure gets them a long ways. And that's where different conversations are in order. And again, let the Holy Spirit lead. Anyway, this has been Michael Bohm, Youth Apologetics Training, taking you through an introduction to evolution. This is just the beginning for evolution. This is a topic that will come up again and again and again over the years. I want to get into every nook and cranny of this subject because I love it. It interests me. I'm infatuated with it. I'm a nerd, and I love it. Anyway, come out to the website, youthapologeticstraining.com, and leave me a comment, a question. Guys, I want to interact with you. Come and see me, youthapologeticstraining.com.
All right, guys, that's it. Thanks for listening. This has been Michael Bohm, and you're listening to the Youth Apologetics Training Podcast. I love you guys, and see you next week. Bring it on,